When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone. So long, farewell to what you thought would go so well. You can hold on like hell, but it doesn't matter how you feel. This is the new real. This is the new real.
Welcome back to Shattered Souls. This is a special bonus podcast.
This is the new real.
We've definitely been in the trenches and have seen some things that people just don't understand. Let me just put it that way.
She's right. That's one of my nearest and dearest co-workers. We'll be hearing a lot from her on this podcast. I wanted to talk to some of the people that I've worked cases with over the years because I wanted different perspectives. I wanted to hear their stories, how they handle the fallout from their cases, whether it's different than how I handle it for mine. And what I found was really interesting. She's going to tell a few of her stories, and we're going to talk in depth about her investigative experiences, her career, and how she went forward when it was all over.
Kimberly Long. I'm a retired detective from the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. I served the Sheriff's Office about 25 years when I retired. This is my first 7 years. I was a patrol officer, and then I transferred to the crime scene unit and spent the remaining 18 years within the crime scene unit as a major crimes detective.
We handled some serious stuff together. We have been in the trenches. We have done some unbelievable things together. You and I were like the frickin' frack of the crime scene unit. We were the most senior people, and we were always the ones that were called out when something serious hit the fan.
That's actually correct. We used to go around when we talked to people, and we would, you know, tell each other, hey, this is my work wife. You know, this is the person I am the closest with. This is the person I spend most of my day with. And unfortunately, the time that we did spend together sometimes was not under the most pleasant circumstances.
Yeah. Why don't you go into that a little bit, Kim? You worked some serious stuff even after I left, and one of them we'll get into shortly, but I have the ones I remember that we worked that sort of stick in my brain. Which ones stick in your brain?
I can't remember exact details because, honestly, sometimes, I guess, I've tried to forget some of them, but some of them are not actual crimes per se, but I definitely remember one where two little brothers had seen their mom put a lighter up on the refrigerator, and then she, I guess, had too much to drink or drugs, but she fell asleep. And the kids, one of the brothers climbed up in the refrigerator, got the lighter, they went into their room. They lived in a mobile home, and they were playing with the lighter, and it caught fire, the room caught fire. And in this particular mobile home, they have a bathroom that's attached to their room, so it's like an ensuite bathroom. And the little boys were trying to get away from the fire. And even when the fire department rescue said that they arrived, they could hear the little boys still screaming. As I was processing the scene, of course, you know, part of it is taking the photographs. And we found the little brothers in the bathroom. And I remember the position that they were laying in, they were kind of like in a yin and yang position, you know, holding their legs, holding their head and that kind of stuff. Then they brought them outside where I had to take additional photographs of them. And when they, you know, pulled the blanket back, the sheet back, they were in their little underoos. And I don't know why, but it's just one of those moments where it just hit me. And I could see them jumping around, screaming, asking for help. And you know, at the time, it didn't bother me because I was doing my job, you know, and that was the thing. We had a job to do. And part of that is we had to take our human emotions and we had to turn them off. We had to turn them off, you know, to do the job that we did. And so I remember at that time, they were going around and they were asking the firefighters, hey, do you guys need somebody to talk to? We're going to send you somebody to talk to. Nobody asked me that. Nobody came to me and said, hey, Kim, are you okay? My lieutenant, my assistant chief came out there. My lieutenant was not there. And none of them came to me and said, hey, Kim, are you okay? Do you need anybody to talk to or anything like that? Not even just the offer. You know, even if I would have said no, they didn't even offer that. And it was probably a couple days later, Karen, I was sitting in a CC's Pizza. I wasn't even at work. And I look up on the TV and they show a picture of the two little boys, and the family was asking for donations because they couldn't afford to bury them. And they were asking for donations. And I broke down in the middle of CC's Pizza in uncontrollable crying sobs. Could not stop myself. And that is one of those things. That's the thing that people don't realize that we encountered, you know, or just seeing where a person was crossing the street and got hit by two or three cars and their body is now mutilated and mangled. And you know the one I'm talking about, the lady that crossed 95.
Yes, I do.
And she was hit by, and just seeing those bodies and just, you know, mutilated or just respond, you know, just going to the scene where family called in and said the little boy was in a vehicle and the vehicle was stolen. And then trying to process that and trying to figure out where the little boy is and to find out that they went and they buried him somewhere and then got to help uncover that, or a grandson killing his grandmother and then wrapping her up and burying her in the backyard. And then you're having to excavate her, you know, or, you know, a boyfriend killing his girlfriend and chopping her up and putting her in different bags and then burying her in like two or three different graves. And you're having to excavate that. And as you're excavating it and you're digging it out, you're coming face to face with these people. And so these are just things that people don't realize. This is what we see. This is what we have to deal with. And then we have to know that somebody that was a human did this to them, that caused this evilness, that caused them to do this.
They didn't even offer you help. That really torques my chain, and here's why. Because of all the people that are responding to these incidents, these crimes, these vicious murders, of all the people who are there the longest, that have to touch the evidence and deal with it and photograph it and collect it and process it and look at it and package it and then testify to it and write about it, we're the ones that have to do all that. And we're the ones that are always forgotten. And it's almost like this suck it up buttercup mentality that we're fine. We've been doing it so long, it doesn't bother us anymore. It couldn't be further from the truth.
Oh, no, you're absolutely correct. That was always the mentality. I don't care whether I was in patrol or when I transferred to the crime scene unit. It's just like you said, suck it up, buttercup. Come on, you're a police officer. You can handle anything. You should be able to handle this. You don't need any help. Yes, we, as the crime scene investigators, we were there the longest. We were the ones that were around the deceased person the longest, looking through that viewfinder and that camera and looking at that deceased person. So we were up close and personal the whole entire scene. It wasn't just like a patrol officer going in and saying, oh, okay, I have a dead person. Let me call crime scene. And then they back out and now they secure the perimeter. We're the ones that are in there. And sometimes we were in there for days.
Yeah, days,
you know,
five, six days.
Yes.
Now obviously the body's been removed, but you're still dealing with the remains, the blood, the bullet trajectories, the decomp, the maggots, the larvae that are left behind, the stains on the carpet, all of the memories that are in that house that you become intimate with these victims in a certain way. You see their photos of their kids and their parents and their grandparents and their spouse, if they have one, and all of these remnants that are left behind. It's not like we can just turn all of that off with a switch.
And we do, and we talk about it too. When we're even in the scenes, we talk about this. We're like, oh, look at this picture, look at this family. You know, oh, they look so happy there. But then the reality is why am I in your house? I'm in my house because somebody's now dead. And it could have been very violent too. The situation behind it, we are trying to, like you said, put our feelings aside as much as possible to show them justice and speak for them. You know, we always say we were the voice of the victim, because we were. We were the ones that were trying to collect the evidence, figure out what happened, who did it.
We were talking the other day and you said that I have to go get some equipment was kind of your out. And that was my out, was I got to go get some equipment. I'll be right back. And I would go sit in my van, drink my coffee, turn on the radio full blast, some rock and roll station, turn on my air conditioning, and just like hit my steering wheel. I would bang on my steering wheel. And that was sort of my moment of release for then. And then the breakdown, like you said, would be at CC's Pizza or would be at the gym or at the pool. Or I would cry underwater more times than I can count. I would let all my emotions out screaming underwater so nobody could hear me. What did you do?
At the scene, if I was at the scene, just like you said, I would, I'd be like, hey, I gotta go out. I gotta get some equipment. So I'd go out to my van. If it was hot, run the AC. And I actually listened to Christian music. So I would turn that up. I would breathe. I even sometimes would even say a quick prayer. God, just help me get through this because I'm really having a hard time right now. Now, when I was away from the job and I was trying to decompress, myself and debrief myself, I used to love to do yard work. I would go out in the middle of the summer at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. And you remember how hot it would get in Jacksonville.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when I would do yard work. It was almost like my punishment in a way that it made me sweat. It made me get tired. It helped me just put my thoughts together or whatever, or just try to get away from all that and just, in a way, kind of scream through the sweating, if that makes sense. But that was it. I had to step away sometimes, just go to the van. Even if I just had to sit on the back of it for a minute and just compose my thoughts so I could go back in and finish my job.
Right. That makes absolutely perfect sense. I would throw weights around until I literally collapsed, and I would have trouble driving home because my body was so exhausted, and that's how I wanted it. I would swim and swim until I almost drowned. I don't know if it was anger or frustration, just that, please, God, get this out of my head, but I just had to get rid of it somehow.
I think it's a combination, to be honest with you. I think it's anger. We get angry because people are doing this, and then sometimes we don't even really understand what could cause a person to reach that point in their life that they would kill another person. And sometimes they did what I would call unspeakable things and acts to the body, or to that person. I think it was a combination of anger, not understanding, the big why. To me, I think that's part of it is it was just anger. And it wasn't anger doing the job because that's what I signed up for. That's what I wanted to do. And I think it also is part depression. I think we were depressed in ways too because we were seeing all this. And it's not something that a normal person, is supposed to see. Especially almost on an everyday basis. How could we be so evil at times?
It's the inconceivable why. We do the who, the what, the where, the when, and the how. We can do that using our evidence. But what we can't answer is the damn why. Every time. And you go to court, prosecution doesn't have to prove motive. They don't have to prove motive. It's not even part of their caseload. So sometimes we walk away never knowing why this ever happened. And maybe that was part of the frustration.
Yeah, and it's probably true because we don't always know why. And we weren't always told this information because there was kind of like a separation between our investigation and what we did as the crime scene investigators and then the other investigators, the other detectives, the homicide investigator or the special assault / sex crimes detective, because the communication, they didn't always kind of tell us what was going on. Oh, okay, thank you. Thank you for getting this evidence. I appreciate it. It's almost like we didn't get closure. I know that sounds odd, but
no, it doesn't. It makes perfect sense. And we would bitch about it.
We were going to have the evidence, which the evidence is what? Evidence is fact. Evidence is what it is. You're not supposed to try to change it and make it fit your story. You're supposed to let the evidence be what it is and then see if that goes along with any statements or whatever. But at times, I think they felt like we weren't important enough to be part of those conversations. There were times I didn't even know that a person had even been arrested.
I was just going to say
until I received the subpoena for deposition. Yep. And then at the deposition, I'm like, oh, okay.
Who is this person? Where'd you find them? How did you get them? Oh, my DNA. You're welcome.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. So it was kind of like not being included and not having that closure too, because we become invested. Just because part of our duties, and job description was to collect evidence doesn't mean that we didn't become involved. We were also investigating this crime too.
Here's a question I have for you. When you were on the witness stand,
I was friends with a lot of defense attorneys. People don't understand that. I'm like, they're not the enemy. They're just doing their job. They're just making sure that we are doing our job so that they can do their job.
I agree with you. They have a job to do. I do not fault them for that. I didn't like it if they tried to, you know, pretty much be a butt, you know, when they were crossing me. And you know what I'm talking
yes,
about.
Yes, I do.
You don't have to be like that. You can ask me questions and not be, you know, a butt about it. I had one, and you would know the gentleman if I mentioned his name, but I'm not going to mention it right now. But if I mention his name, you would know who I was talking about because you had trial with him, and he was the defense attorney.
Okay.
And he didn't ask me any questions. So they took a break after, you know, I testified and I saw him and he was like, hey, and I'm like, hey, how you doing? I'm not going to be rude to him. You know, I'm like, hey. And I'm like, no questions. And he's like, when you're good, like you are, you're good. I didn't have anything for you.
Good for you. Good for you. And so isn't that a great feeling when you just,
yeah.
I've actually had defense attorneys in the hallway shake my hand and say thank you for the job that you did.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
With the best all-inclusive vacation deals to Mexico and the Caribbean, booking your getaway with Cheap Caribbean Vacations means you have more freedom to do your deal. Whether you want to enjoy snorkeling, endless margaritas and more, or simply soak up the sun and sand in a tropical paradise, Cheap Caribbean Vacations has your deal for that. Plan and book the exact getaway you want at exactly the right price for you by using our exclusive budget beach finder, or find a featured all-inclusive package to Generations Riviera Maya Resort and do your deal at cheapcaribbean.com.
Yes.
We talked about this the other day. Stacey Replogle.
Mm-hmm.
I did episodes 1 and 2. I talked about her case and how it really messed with my head and continues to, believe it or not, to this day. I still have this horrible dream about her every once in a while that sort of comes back to haunt me. Do you have cases like that that you've taken home that just won't go away, Kim?
Yes.
Can you talk about them?
Yes. Yes, actually, I can. I'll talk about the one that sticks out more than anything. You know, there's always a little something from each case or from some cases that kind of stick out. The one case really just sticks out in my head. I think about it all the time is Cherish Periwinkle. You had already left. It is one that will be etched in my mind for the rest of my life.
Can you give a little background on the case just for people that might not know?
I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest version.
Okay.
Basically, Cherish, who was, I believe, 8 years old, was at a Dollar General with her mother and two other little sisters, younger sisters. And they were inside, and of course, you know, like little kids, they wanted mom to buy them things. And the mom was like, I don't have the money, I can't do it. Well, it just happened that the suspect, the defendant, whatever you want to call him, the monster, Donald Smith, happened to be there. And he had already been convicted as a sexual predator. He had just gotten out of jail, not even 30 days prior to this, if even that. And he just happened to be in there. And unfortunately, I think it was an opportunity of, you know, just one of those chance opportunities. He happened to be there. He waited around for about an hour or so, and finally made contact with the mom as they were leaving. He said, hey, I have a Walmart gift card. My wife's going to meet me at Walmart. If you want, I'll take you up there. We'll buy your kids some stuff. I understand what it's like. And so the mother said, okay. And she loaded up all her kids and they went to Walmart. They walked around Walmart for, I don't know, maybe an hour, 2 hours, trying on clothes and this and that. There were some things that he did while they were there. I think it was very suspect, but the mother should have said, oh my goodness, something's going on here, when he wanted little Cherish to put on these little high heel type shoes and walk around in them and that kind of stuff. I think he maybe even gone into the changing room with her at one point. The mother was still allowing it to happen. So he said, hey, listen, I'm going to go up to the front. Most people know most Walmarts have like a McDonald's in the store. He said, I'm going to go up front. I'm going to get us all some cheeseburgers. Cherish, why don't you walk up here with me? They go up there. Of course, the McDonald's is closed. And then you see him and Cherish walking out of the Walmart, going to his vehicle, and then she was not seen alive after that. We knew that we were looking for a particular vehicle, and they just happened to see... Did you ever work with Tina Henson?
Yeah, we were in the academy together.
Okay, well, Tina was on a traffic crash at 95, and guess what happens to drive by is... the van. And so she gets behind it and follows it. They're able to get K-9, other vehicles. They're able to get him stopped. When they stop him, of course, unfortunately, Terrace was not in the back of the van, but it was him. His clothes were wet. And in the meantime, we had two witnesses calling in saying, hey, we saw this particular van at this church in the wood line near the like the creek. And so K-9 went up there and they were able to locate Cherish. She was in the water. She'd been submerged in the water. And he had weighed her down with like pieces of asphalt. And she was still wearing her little dress, but that was all she was wearing at the time. And of course, you know, she was deceased and everything. So my part, of course, was the processing of the scene, the you know, the photographs and trying to collect any type of evidence that you collect at that time.
So what it's heartbreaking. It's like I'm trying to picture it in my mind and I don't want to, but then it keeps coming back. And I don't know what it looked like because I don't know what the crime scene was. I can imagine. And I know it was horrific. I also know that Donald Smith, didn't he sexually assault her as well?
Yes. When we found her, she was still wearing her little flower dress. He submerged her in the water, you know, I guess hoping that maybe we would never find her. And when we did find her, her dress was pulled up so you could see like parts of her body and everything. When we turned her over, there was the petechia hemorrhaging in her eyes and on her neck. So we already knew at that point when we saw that she'd been strangled. I mean, that's a classic sign of manual strangulation. And so we knew she'd been strangled. And knowing that he was a sexual predator, we were pretty sure that he had sexually assaulted her. And the autopsy confirmed that. And I'll be honest with you, Karen, I didn't think it was going to do any good. But I said I'd like to go ahead and collect some DNA swabs from her body that I could collect, i.e. the neck. The medical examiner, Dr. Rao, she actually came out there. And she said, absolutely, go for it. She allowed me to collect those swabs. What really blew my mind on that case, Karen, is I got touch DNA, full profile, off of her neck. And she had been submerged in water.
Damn.
Of Donald Smith.
You should be preaching that to the skies, my dear. That is unbelievable.
I do. And I think part of what kind of keeps me in that case is when I do go to conferences and stuff, I actually have like a little presentation where I kind of go through the case and everything. And part of it is I talk about that. Just because you get an item or something that's in water, do not discount the fact that there might be touch DNA on it.
Good for you.
You never know. Never know. And I didn't even know until I went to my pretrial. And Mark Khalil, who was the attorney, was like, oh yeah, by the way, oh yeah, you got a full profile.
He said that as an aside. I mean, I'm not blaming Mark by any stretch. I love Mark Khalil, but that is amazing that Homicide didn't call you. The lab didn't call you. Your supervisor didn't call you. Nobody called and said, Kim, God.
No, I did not know until we were going to trial. And mind you, we were going to trial almost 5 years later. Five years later, Karen, I find out, okay? I find out.
I would have hit the roof. So angry, I would have hit the roof that nobody bothered to tell me that.
Well, I was quite upset. Let me tell you, I was quite upset. And then to come find out that the result was like, and I don't remember the exact number, but it was quadrillion, I think it was on that one.
Wow.
Quadrillion. Anyway, so what were we talking
about? No, anyway.
I'm
sitting here with my mouth agape going, that is some damn good crime scene work right there. So you know what? Hold on. I will give you the standing O right now, sister, because that is some awesome stuff. Good for you.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you. But I think the thing I remember the most about this case, though, is just the body. The fact that she's a little girl. And her innocence being taken away. And just what was she thinking about when all this was going on? And these are the things that people don't get. We think about this stuff. You know, it's stuff that goes through. I do. It's what's going through my mind as I'm processing this stuff is this poor child. What was she thinking? Was she probably crying out for her mom? You know, things like that. You know, that's what I think about. And that's the kind of stuff that just stays with me.
Where do you compartmentalize that, Kim? Where do you compartmentalize that in your head? Because that is something that's never going to go away. How do you A, push it aside when you're at the scene, and then once everything's said and done and the reports are done and you have time to sort of let it sink in, what do you do?
I don't know. I've just been given the ability, I guess you could say. I don't want to say it doesn't affect me mentally or emotionally, but not to the point that I can't focus and be a human, if that makes sense. That I wish I had a better way of answering that for you. I really do.
Do you turn to your faith?
You know, absolutely. I turn to my faith. And I guess that's what it comes down to, is God gave me a peace. And he, you know, it's almost like he's like, thank you for what you're doing. So I'm going to give you this strength and this peace and this comfort that you're able to continue to do this work, this gift that I've given you, because to me, it's a gift. We have a gift of going into these scenes and working these scenes and being able to put them in that compartment. We have choices every day. Everything that we do in our life, we have choices. Either do something or not do something. And unfortunately, some people have chosen to do things, and these things are violent things. And so that's kind of like what I turn to, is just that faith.
I remember the last scene, the last major case you and I worked together was 2 or 3 days, and it was, I can't mention his name because it's an open case, but you know which one I'm talking about. The elderly gentleman in the living room.
Yes.
And I remember walking into that living room, and you know, he was a hoarder. There was, I mean, stuff was everywhere, but blood was everywhere. There wasn't a surface of that living room that was not covered in blood, and it was horrible. And I remember walking in and using my outside voice and saying, yeah, I've seen worse. That was my moment where I went, you are done. You're done. This is not for you anymore. Your path has changed. It's time. And I think it was that week that I started searching for jobs, because I said, you know what? I can't do this anymore. It's not that my heart wasn't in it. I was burned out. I was exhausted. I was turning into a jaded, sarcastic person. And it was not the person, A, that I came in as. Didn't expect to be the same person when I left. However, I did not want to be that angry, nasty person that I was turning into anymore. Honestly, that's why I left. That was the end of the road for me.
I can relate in a way to that, not wanting to be that person. You know, we sometimes would go into these crime scenes and we would, I don't want to say we joked about it, but we joked about it.
We talked about things.
Because
you had to.
But that was our way of coping during that time while we were doing it. However, it's one thing to laugh at a crime scene and just kind of joke around, because that's what you need to do to kind of get through things. But if you're going in there and you're really starting to become cut off from the world, unfeeling, you don't care, when you start getting to that point, then yes, you need to get out. You need to get away from it. You need to do something else, because it's not good for you. And you saw that, and I commend you for that. I cannot do this anymore because of this reason, and I need to go find something else to do, you know? So I actually commend you for doing that.
Well, thanks. No, I agree. And that's what was happening. I just backed out because I knew that it was changing my whole personality, and it's not who I was. I'm a fun, happy person for the most part. I love to laugh. I love to joke around, you know, Karenisms.
Yeah.
The Karenisms were my trademark. I came up with them all the time, and that was sort of my go-to. Yes. And when the Karenisms disappeared and I dreaded going to work because I knew it was going to be a shitstorm, it was just one of those things where I said, you know what? There's other things out there for me, and it'll be okay. It was the hardest decision I ever made, but it was the best decision I ever made.
It's always going to be with me too. You know, things that we've done, things that we've seen, it's always going to be with me. Because I truly believe we all have a form of PTSD, especially first responders. I totally believe we have it because of what we see. We don't get the help that we need. You know, if you look at statistics and interviews and that kind of stuff, suicides for first responders is on the rise, way on the rise right now, 6 or 7%. And it's because we all have this mentality of, oh, I'm a police officer. I'm strong. I don't need to talk to anybody. I can handle this myself. But in reality, we need the help. We need somebody to talk to, you know, and we're just not getting that.
All right. One last question. You teach a lot of new crime scene investigators, and seasoned ones as well. There are a lot of people that are going to listen to this podcast that are thinking, oh my God, forensics, it's so glamorous, it's so exciting, and I want to do it. What's the best advice that you have for folks that are thinking about this as a career and for folks who have done it for a short amount of time but haven't gotten into the thick of it yet?
First of all, somebody that's thinking about going into it, it's not all glamour, like you said. It's not NCIS or CSI or whatever those shows are that I don't watch. It's not that. It's not about all this glamour, like you said. It's dirty. It can be a very dirty job, and I mean physically dirty job. It can be a physically demanding job. You're going to have to work in heat, cold, where it's just, it stinks environment, you know, from the decomp. You are going to see things that you think that you're okay with, but you may not be able to handle. You really got to know what you're going into. Don't look at the glamour aspect of it. Know that you are going to be physically demanded to do things, but also know that you may not get the respect that you think you're going to get because of the job that you do. And that's one thing, is you got to be thick skinned. You got to be able to put up with a lot and see a lot. And for the people that are already in it, education, 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 education. Just keep learning, go to classes, go to conferences. Immerse yourself. Know that there are new and different techniques out there. Learn about them. Try to apply them. Work with your department. Try to learn to work with your investigators. Communication. Try to have a good working relationship. We've been through a lot. We've seen a lot. We've been through a lot just as people, as friends, you know, good and bad and ugly.
Yeah.
And the fact that we can say that we are where we're at and that it's a good thing. You know, and that we've, I guess, hopefully come full circle. I wish you the best of luck. Don't be a stranger.
Absolutely not. And I wish you the best as well, my dear. Thank you so much, Kim.
You're welcome.
This is the new real.
Opening music by Sam Johnson at samjohnsonlive.com. Underscore music by Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com. All rights reserved by Angel Heart Productions.
Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Welcome back. What if we told you about a major breakthrough on awesome savings on all-inclusive beach vacays?
OMG, this could break the case.
Case? I'm talking about CheapCaribbean.com.
Ooh, is it full of chilling intrigue?
No, it's full of hot savings. CheapCaribbean.com's semi-annual sale is helping you save $200 off your next booking for 4 nights or more. Score site-wide deals to your favorite beaches in Cancun, Aruba, Jamaica, and more now through the end of April.
We gotta take this show on the road.
Let's start at CheapCaribbean.com.